Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Mind, Consciousness, and Well-Being. Edited by Daniel J. Siegel and Marion F. Solomon. Narrated by Paul Bryan. Publisher's Note: This audiobook refers to figures included in the print and ebook editions of the book. Introduction by Daniel J. Siegel, M.D. Welcome to Mind, Consciousness, and Well-Being. In this compilation of 15 presentations by leaders in the fields of mental health and contemplation, science, and spiritual exploration, you'll hear from scientists, clinicians, and mindfulness teachers about research and practical applications for training the mind to bring more health and flourishing to our lives. Marion Solomon, Bonnie Goldstein, and I organize a conference on this topic for one of our annual interpersonal neurobiology conferences, which have spanned over 2 decades, hosted by the Lifespan Learning Institute. As the Institute's medical director, I'm honored to work with them to facilitate these conferences, and then in some cases to transform the proceedings from those events into book format, such as this text. Because the feeling that emerged in the flow of presentations at this event was so empowering and accessible, we have chosen to leave each of the following chapters as close to the transcript of the offering as possible. What this means is that you, as the listener, will have a chance to also experience the flow of exercises, audience engagement, jokes, and even at times poignant moments that spontaneously arose in the course of doing live presentations. Many books are available on meditation, on mental training, and on consciousness. So why choose to spend your time listening to this volume? As the founding editor of the Norton series on interpersonal neurobiology, of which this book is a part, and with this being a recounting of one of our annual UCLA Interpersonal Neurobiology conferences, I imagine you would think I am biased when I say that the format of this text is especially accessible, informative, and even fun. As the co-editor of the book, I know we could have chosen to encourage our presenters to formalize each of these chapters, but leaving them in this flowing format, both in their sequence and in their substance, offers a unique window into the science and art of taking our understanding of the mind and consciousness and applying it to cultivating well-being in our personal lives and our professional work. Join the conversation. As you move forward throughout each of the presentations, please keep in mind that these are conversations you are invited to join in, reflecting inside your own mind, as well as in conversations that might emerge with others, what the speaker, and at times the comments and questions of the participants, focus on regarding the nature of mind, consciousness, and well-being. Mindfulness, compassion, and well-being. You'll first hear from the neuroscientist Amishi P. Jha, Ph.D., and colleagues, who offer new material on their research into the study of attention, resilience, and mindfulness that builds on their work with high-stress professionals, such as first responders in the military. This reformatted chapter is the one exception to the transcription approach, as exciting, new, yet-to-be-published material that arose after the conference now organizes this offering. Their insights reveal that training the mind to focus attention and open awareness provides a foundation for building more resilience and a decrease in burnout. Next, you'll have the treat of learning from two beloved mindfulness teachers, Trudy Goodman Cornfield, Ph.D., and Jack Cornfield, Ph.D., who explore the notion of loving awareness as the foundation for mindful living. Loving awareness means both awareness filled with love and the experience of loving being aware. As we'll see, Trudy and Jack's powerful exercises empower us to deepen our capacity to focus attention, open awareness, and build loving kindness, the capacity to be compassionate and kind with our inner and interpersonal worlds. Shauna Shapiro, Ph.D., is a mindfulness researcher and clinical psychologist whose important research reveals how mindfulness training can help build empathy and compassion in clinicians, such as physicians and medical students. Along with her colleagues, Shauna has inspired us to view mindfulness as having the components of attention, intention, and a kind attitude that shows how being mindful is filled with a positive regard to ourselves and those around us. You'll experience in this powerful presentation how what we practice grows stronger is a principle accessing the ways in which the mind can transform a state during practice into a trait of long-term ways we come to live more mindfully. In our fourth chapter, Self-compassion pioneer Kristen Neff, Ph.D., provides exciting science and practical tools for cultivating what controlled studies now reveal are an important way to bring more well-being into our lives. Self-compassion in Kristen's important framework includes not only being mindful and having a kind regard to one's inner experience, but also realizing that you are a part of a larger humanity, broader than your private, isolated self. Self-compassion is a robust way we create well-being in our lives, an inner compassion that is beyond the self-esteem factor so dependent on our achievements. This is a gift of kindness that keeps on giving. Next, Judson Brewer, MD, PhD, provides a deep dive into his illuminating work, helping us understand how being aware of our inner world with kindness and compassion, being mindful, can provide relief to addictive conditions, as well as other ways we experience suffering along our human journeys. By exploring the neural correlates of the experience of self, Judd has provided us all with important insights into a set of interconnected circuits called the Default Mode Network, DMN, and its role in evaluating not only what we think of ourselves, but what others think of us as well. You might imagine that our addiction to social media may in part engage this DMN preoccupation and give us FOMO, the fear of missing out. Don't miss out on his great insights. Gary Small, MD, continues our focus on the brain in Chapter 6, looking at the impact of experience on the neuroplastic changes that may help us either prevent or become predisposed to neurological dysfunction, such as dementia, as we age. Gary was one of my first teachers at UCLA when I was a psychiatric resident. I published my first paper with him back then, and in this insightful presentation, he has maintained his wonderful sense of humor and keen eye on what is practical in bringing health into our lives. Gary's Longevity Center at UCLA was a co-host for our gathering. Helen Lavretsky, MD, also works at the Longevity Center and brings her engaging style and wit to guide us through her research and its practical implications for utilizing breath practices to cultivate well-being. Her work on the physiological mechanisms of health builds on some of the work of Alyssa Eppel and Elizabeth Blackburn, who have demonstrated that being present in our awareness can actually optimize the levels of the enzyme telomerase, which repairs and maintains the ends of our chromosomes. Helen's work shows that with easy-to-learn exercises focusing the mind's awareness on the breath, we can alter our internal bodily milieu to create health as we reduce inflammation. Yes, your mind can change the medical state of your body. Next, Elisha Goldstein, Ph.D., takes us on a journey into how other salutary and research-established effects of learning to be more mindful in our lives can help prevent relapse into depression and elevate our mood from the dysphoric states we may experience. Elisha's practical tools help clinicians see how a first step in treating individuals suffering from a lack of belonging and disconnection would be to help them become connected to themselves and to others. Mindful awareness, as you'll see, not only changes our internal state, but also it offers a direct way to enhance our relationships in our lives. The relationship between the client and the therapist has been a focus of the powerful research of Sherry Geller, Ph.D., who here offers us practical ways to understand and cultivate therapeutic presence, how we show up for our clients, how we embody being aware and receptive. This has been shown in controlled studies to be not only a key ingredient to effective therapeutic outcome, but also a learnable skill. Sherry's important work reminds us that being present therapeutically is something we can put in the front of our minds before each therapy session, reminding ourselves of the importance of being mindfully aware, of being open, being receptive, and not taking our judgments too seriously so that we are fully present for the experience. Our next set of presentations moves us forward into exciting further discussions about the nature of presence and what it means for our relationships, with other people, with all of nature, and even with all of reality. Separation, integration, and our sense of self. In many ways, the cognitive science view of bottom-up and top-down offer a helpful framework in which to place some of these findings of each of the presenters. Bottom-up is a term that can be used to refer to the notion that incoming energy patterns are received with as little filtering as possible. These raw data are in contrast to top-down processing, in which prior learning funnels incoming energy patterns rapidly into pre-established pattern groupings. When we see someone in front of us, We often filter the perception of that individual into a set of predetermined groupings that may include race, gender, religious affiliation, and nationality. Research has shown that with an in-group, out-group distinction rapidly made, we either place individuals into the former and treat them with more kindness and care, or place them in the latter group and treat them with more hostility, disrespect, and even dehumanization. To expand on this bottom-up versus top-down notion, we can examine, on a more perceptual, individual-free level, the following example. If you are familiar with the reality of boats, then an object you may see on the water entering your eyes as a set of photons from a shimmering something out at sea might be seen in your perceptual system as what you already know might exist out there on the surface of the ocean, a boat. While this may be your mental conclusion, it might actually be a perceptual illusion. Instead of being a boat, it might be a whale, a plane that has crashed, or a pile of trash. Your top-down brain survives by being able to predict from what it already knows, detect patterns from sensation, and try to fit these into your pre-existing mental models. It has a rapid way to organize energy flow into pre-existing sets. One suggested sequence in this top-down processing of sets is this. We presume that categories are divisions in the natural world. We might imagine these categories to be innate aspects of the world, when in fact they are actually mental observations, patterns observed and presumed, and cognitive categories constructed. An example might be animate versus inanimate categories of things in the world. Natural, right? We then construct mental concepts, general ideas that reveal the categorical divisions we have observed and presumed to be real. Here, we have the concept of living versus non-living things. Fine, you might say. And finally, we have symbols, the way we represent our concepts and categories about the world. There is the living world of animate beings, and there is the non-living world of material objects. We can paint, dance, make music, and most directly use linguistic symbols, words, to represent or represent these ways of experiencing the categorically divided, conceptually organized, mentally constructed world. We have words for plants, words for animals, and the concept of the two kingdoms of animals and plants. You cannot show me animal or plant. You can only show examples of what we mean by these linguistic symbols of a concept of a category, animal or plant. Professor of Law Rhonda McGee J.D. and I explore these top-down implicit judgments we often carry with us in a direct conversation between us, a black woman and a white man. Rhonda's important work in the field of social justice has been inspiring to many across a range of disciplines and reveals how these ways the mind prejudges those around us can be understood at the root of marginalization and disempowerment of racism and social inequity. The experience of this session, which we hope you will sense in the direct transcription of the spontaneous interactions and communication, enables us to see how presence is a starting point for engaging in open, honest, and vulnerable conversations about how we connect with one another. Presence, in many ways, this open awareness, enables us to be conscious before and beneath the categories, concepts, and symbols that reveal the top-down ways we have become unknowingly shaped by prior learning from home, school, and society. Pat Ogden, Ph.D., and Bonnie Goldstein, Ph.D., then take us on a deep dive into sensing presence both in the body and in our relational interactions with one another. They provide us with specific clinical sessions to show how being aware of the body's sensations and movement forms an important cornerstone for applying the principles we've been discussing through the lens of sensory-motor psychotherapy. A concept that emerges in their discussion is that of unity, our deep interconnectedness. This focus parallels a broad notion from the field of interpersonal neurobiology in a consilient way. When we link differentiated elements of a complex system, a process we can name integration arises. The key feature of integration is that the linking does not remove or reduce the differentiated aspects of these unique components of the system. Integration in this way is how the synergistic process arises, in which the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. In many ways, the powerful cases you'll experience in Pat and Bonnie's presentation are beautiful examples of integration at work in therapy. It may be that integration is the basis of well-being. With 18 interns helping me revise my original text on interpersonal neurobiology, The Developing Mind, into its third edition, we could only find support for this simple proposal. Whether we look at the brain and the head, as we will do later in Rudolf Tanzi PhD's presentation, or larger issues related to how humans live on the living planet and impact its well-being, as we'll discuss in various ways in the subsequent presentations, linking differentiated parts of a system, integration, may be necessary for well-being to emerge at whatever level of system we are examining. The presentation by Deepak Chopra, MD, next takes us in an important but in some ways distinct direction from our earlier discussions. By diving into the ways in which physics and cosmology view the nature of the universe, we'll see that our experience of being a self may have the appearance of a kind of solidity that is not supported by a deep physics view of reality. Though we may have the perception of a self that has substance and a center of narrative gravity, this may be an illusion emerging from the substance of the brain, not the solidity of being here. How consciousness fits into this larger view of reality is an open point of discussion that Deepak invites us to explore. As you'll see soon, this view can feel somewhat disorienting, and some question its validity. Don't we know for sure that we are here and that our sense of self is real? Isn't the solidity of our body, the solid aspect of matter, proof that we are substantive beings in the world? Wouldn't the mind and consciousness merely be outcomes of that solidity? In physics, it is proposed that we have at least two realms of our one reality. One is of the large accumulations of energy we call mass. Recall, energy equals mass times speed of light squared, or E equals mc squared. This macro state world has the appearance of things being noun-like distinct entities with interactions, but fundamentally separated from each other. This macro state realm is governed by the laws Isaac Newton discovered, so this realm is linguistically symbolized with the terms macro state, Newtonian, or classical physics. In the micro state realm of basic units of energy called quanta, what physicists and mathematicians call probability fields, such as electrons or photons, a different set of properties govern behavior. This microstate or quantum realm has the qualities of being filled with verb-like events that are deeply interconnected. We can propose that our sense of self emerges with elements of both the macrostate Newtonian classical world of noun-like distinct entities and the microstate quantum realm of verb-like interconnected events. The presentation by Rudolf Tanzi, PhD, shows us that this sense of self is correlated with our integrated functioning of the brain. With Alzheimer's dementia, for example, we are facing an epidemic of disintegration within the brain that is accompanied by a dissolution of the sense of self that appears to begin in the head's brain long before symptoms or signs of the disorder become apparent to individuals or those around them. In some ways, we can suggest that this is how our noun-like sense of self dissolves as we lose forms of memory and narratives of who and what we are. You'll learn about important new notions of how inflammation and possibly even infection in the substance of the brain may be at the root of this condition, and how we might be able to prevent such damaging processes from occurring. Next, Minas Kafatos, PhD, offers us his view as a physicist of the nature of reality and how presence is fundamental to our universe. By articulating principles of physics, we can see how our awareness of the natural world is mirrored in how we show up for life, how we live the living presence fully to promote well-being and peace in our being here. Minas's and Deepak's deep dive into physics helps us sense a practical application that you'll see in the final chapter, where I attempt to build on these wonderful and diverse presentations to explore one way of symbolizing, conceptualizing, and categorizing the nature of the mind. The mind is what the mind is, however we use that term. But sharing insights from science and direct practice are often facilitated in a helpful and impactful way using words. With accuracy, we may be able to say that anything expressed with words is already wrong, or at least incomplete, meaning that words not being the thing itself, the notions can at best be only partially true. Even with this limitation in mind, we can use words, concepts, and presumed categorizations in the world to explore and apply scientific principles and findings to ask some questions that are perhaps at the heart of each of our presentations, such as, what is the mind? What is consciousness? What is well-being? You may have noticed that these are the three symbolic terms of the title of this set of presentations, and this is no accident. Whether you are in the field of mental health, education, science, or parenting, or simply are a citizen of our world wanting to know more about life, the ideas and skills you'll learn firsthand here in this book will provide a deep exploration of how we might illuminate possible answers to these three questions. This final chapter builds on some of these top-down notions of mind, consciousness, and well-being by actually starting with a bottom-up experience with a practice called the Wheel of Awareness. This will allow you to build on your prior experiential exercises as you experience this integrative reflective journey yourself, before, beneath, and beyond these words. You'll see how to differentiate the knowing of consciousness from the knowns, and then systematically link them to one another. This first-person immersion enables your direct subjective experience to be a starting place for then moving to second-person data, the reports from others of their own direct subjective experience. When we then collate data from thousands of individuals doing the wheel into third-person reports, you'll come to see patterns that if you're up for letting categories and concepts arise, we might be able to articulate with words in ways that might be helpful to construct a broad framework for understanding the mind, consciousness, and well-being. One of the simple perspectives that emerges with the wheel practice is that we can live in both realms we've introduced here, the macro state noun-like world of distinct entities and the micro state verb-like world of interconnected events. You'll be able to swim between these two realms in the wheel practice and learn to access the important facets of each realm in your life. One of the lessons emerging from our survey of the wheel is the sense of an integrated self that arises when both realms are accessed and linked. One is the self as a noun-like, distinct, and unique I or me that lives in the body we were born into. This is the realm that has an arrow of time or directionality of change. We have about a century to live in these bodies. That time constraint is real, and our awareness of it is really important. The other is the facet of self that is a verb-like set of unfolding events that have deep interconnection in a realm that is more quantum, without an arrow of time, without a directionality of change. In some ways, this is a timeless world. The world, as you'll see, of pure awareness. From an existential perspective, this may be the origin of our relational self, a way of living in relational interconnections as us or we, connected to not only other people, but to all of nature, here and now, and across the dimension of reality we've named time. Recalling the sequence of category, concept, symbol, and that the terms me and we are linguistic symbols, we can, with humility and receptivity, imagine what an integration of these two facets of self might be like. As integration is the term we are using for the linkage of differentiated parts, we can suggest that one way of seeing the well-being of integration arising in these distinct realms of self is with this simple equation. Me plus we equals mui. We are happy to join with you in this set of wondrous presentations. Each has its own unique flavor and focus. Linked together, without losing the distinctness of each, they can take us on an integrated flow of experiential immersions and insightful ideas about the nature of mind, consciousness, and well-being. Welcome to the journey ahead. 1. Strengthening Attention with Mindfulness Training in Workplace Settings. By Ekaterina Denkova, Anthony P. Zanesco, Alexandra B. Morrison, Joshua Rooks, Scott L. Rogers, and Amishi P. Jha. At any given moment, the human brain is inundated with an enormous and varied array of sensory stimuli from the external environment. Simultaneously, the mind can easily generate a myriad of ideas, memories, and emotions, spontaneously and without any external input. In stark contrast to the enormity of information available to the brain in any given moment, its capacity to fully process or act on all that is happening is relatively limited. The human brain's attention system is evolution's solution to this conundrum of too much information and too little computational power. Attentional mechanisms restrict processing so that only a subset of information receives privileged access to the brain's computational resources for further analyses. Attention biases brain activity in favor of what is relevant and disadvantages irrelevant or distracting information. Attention is part of a broader family of processes known as executive functions, EFs, which select and monitor behavior in support of attaining specific goals. These goals can be momentary and rely on perceptual input from the environment, such as stopping at a red light, or protracted in time and complex, such as submitting a report or learning how to use a new workplace billing system. Professional environments, whether corporate or medical offices, educational institutions, or a variety of other work settings, present a rich daily context in which most adults must expend many hours engaging in work that is attentionally demanding. Indeed, the importance of attention and EFs more broadly in workplace settings cannot be underestimated. Yet, failures of attention are ubiquitous in the workplace. What's worse is that attention is degraded by such factors as stress, negative mood, and social threat, which typify many workplace settings. For example, work-related burnout and stressors have been linked to attention failures. Thus, there has been growing interest in determining if attention can be made stronger and more resilient to these detrimental factors by introducing training interventions in workplaces. One form of training that has shown promise is mindfulness training, MT. Yet, the bulk of the literature on the utility of MT in the workplace is limited in scope. While evidence is amassing on MT's ability to reduce stress and improve mood, very few studies have examined MT's impact on attention in organizational settings. The broad aims of this chapter are as follows. First, we elaborate on what EFs are and discuss current hypotheses regarding how MT exercises may strengthen them. Next, we review the utility and effectiveness of MT in bolstering attention and other EFs in workplace settings, particularly during high-demand intervals in military service members. Then we examine a case study in which short-form MT was offered during the workday in an accounting firm to determine if attentional task performance improved over a 10-week interval. We conclude by suggesting that more research is needed on MT's ability to bolster attention and recommending MT training parameters that may be critical for achieving attentional benefits. What are executive functions and how might MT strengthen them? EFs, such as attention, are critical for successfully adapting to ever-changing circumstances that may be cognitively, emotionally, and socially challenging. EFs comprise multiple complex, higher-order cognitive control processes that are necessary to select goal-relevant information and overcome habitual and automatic responses. Perspective-taking, decision-making, problem-solving, planning, and other cognitive processes rely on EFs. In addition, a growing body of evidence reveals that EFs play an important role in emotion processing and the ability to successfully regulate emotional responding. Relatedly, it has been suggested that stronger executive function is a protective factor against negative mood in people who tend to have ruminative and worry-related thoughts, which are typically associated with poor physical and mental health in employees. In addition, the integrity of EFs has been suggested to play a critical role in social skills, as well as real-life performance outcomes, such as academic achievement and job performance. Thus, because EFs impact multiple domains, cognitive, emotional, social, and performance, there has been increased interest in interventions that may improve EFs. While critical for a range of activities, attentional processes and other EFs are limited in capacity and vulnerable to degradation. This degradation is particularly striking over high-stress/high-demand intervals. Presumably, when EFs are heavily and repeatedly taxed in the service of A. cognitive demands, such as decision-making and problem-solving, B. emotion regulation in the face of emotional challenges, and C. social/interpersonal challenges. Decline in attentional task performance has been reported during high-demand periods such as the academic semester in undergraduates and pre-season athletic training in college football players. Thus, EFs are critically important but vulnerable and prone to degradation over demanding intervals. One form of training proposed to improve EFs and promote cognitive resilience is MT. Mindfulness is described as a mental mode characterized by attention to present moment experience without judgment, elaboration, or emotional reactivity. MT programs offer exercises and didactic content on how to direct and stabilize attention towards present moment experience. A key question is how MT exercises are able to engage and strengthen EFs. A cognitive training perspective proposes that core EFs that are engaged by a particular activity.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?